This is only a game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Barry, busted, screamed the headlines. Busted for steroids? Well, no, but the New York Daily News reported this week that San Francisco Giants slugger Barry Bonds tested positive for amphetamines last summer. Bonds responded by saying he took something from a teammate's locker without knowing what it was. He later said he didn't do that at all. A first positive test for amphetamines doesn't call for a suspension, but does it make the gloomy cloud of allegation and suspicion hanging over Bonds as he attempts to break the all-time home run record even gloomier? Joining me now on the line is ESPN's Tim Kirkchin. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Nice to be here, Bill.
Yes, January. Must be time for some baseball talk, I guess.
Baseball never ends, Bill, even in January.
Apparently not. On Thursday, Barry Bonds issued a Jason Giambi-esque apology to the Giants, his teammates, the city of San Francisco, and Major League Baseball, without reference to the offense for which he was apologizing, interestingly enough. So is all right with the world, or does this story continue?
Well, I'm afraid this story is going to continue. Now, maybe not the amphetamine story with Barry Bonds is going to continue forever, but Barry Bonds and his connection to illegal substances, performance enhancers, whatever, I'm afraid that story is never going to go away. And this time, Barry Bonds is not going to have this defense. I've never tested positive for anything. I've never been caught doing anything, you know, you can test me all you want. I've never had a positive test. Well, now it appears he has. So he has lost that defense. The difference, of course, is, and even though amphetamines are performance enhancers, they are not viewed in the same way that steroids have been because, you know, guys have been doing amphetamines for years and years and years. And it was almost something that guys bragged about in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So this needs to be treated slightly differently than being caught with steroids.
Mark McGwire was not elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame this week despite all his home runs because of overwhelming circumstantial evidence of his steroid use while he was playing. But you voted for him. How come?
I voted for him, Bill, because I am married to a lawyer and I am the son of a mathematician. And in all seriousness, I just didn't have enough proof or hard evidence about exactly what this guy did to not vote for him. And I really don't want to get corny about this, but I went to journalism school, and we talked about fairness and accuracy for 4 years. That was the key. And even though people tell me, well, this is different, this is baseball, I still think the principle of fairness still needs to apply here. And the only thing that we really know for sure is he did androstenedione, which is a steroid, but it was over-the-counter. It wasn't on baseball's banned list. And when they told him to stop taking it, he stopped taking it. At least that's all we know right now. And to me, that's not enough to keep a guy out of the Hall of Fame.
To some extent, McGwire has been punished for not answering questions about steroids that probably should have been asked during the McGwire-Sosa Derby days when everybody was so excited about the rebirth of baseball. Is this moral stand taken by writers who didn't vote for him something that's happening about 10 years too late?
I think so. Just like the whole process is 10 years too late. To keep Mark McGwire out of the Hall of Fame because he made a fool of himself in front of Congress that day, I'm sorry, that's not who we're voting on for the Hall of Fame. That's not what we're voting about for the Hall of Fame. We're voting about a player and what he did on the field, not what he did in front of Congress. He got some bad legal advice. He doesn't express himself very well anyway. That's not the reason to keep him out of the Hall of Fame. We are absolutely celebrating the two San Francisco Chronicle reporters for not testifying about what they know here, and they are heroes, and I love those guys. Don't get me wrong. Mark McGwire did something similar to that, and he's the greatest villain of all time. I wish he'd answered the question, or he shouldn't have showed up at all. He really didn't do himself very much good that day. In fact, he hurt himself that day, but that's not the reason you should keep him out of the Hall of Fame.
Some baseball fans may have noticed that a couple of guys did get into the Hall of Fame this time around. We ought to talk a little bit about Tony Gwynn and Cal Ripken Jr. These are special guys.
Well, they are. Tony Gwynn is one of the great craftsmen I've ever seen, Bill, in the game. He studies tape like nobody else, and he was 15 years ahead of anybody else watching tapes of his at-bats. He used to carry them with him on the road in a gigantic trunk to make sure he could see how pitchers were pitching him. He's got the littlest hands of any star player I've ever seen. He used this tiny little bat, and he once told me that there was a teammate, Scott Livingstone of his, who could Tony could close his eyes and he could pick up his bat and Scott Livingstone's bat, which were exactly the same size, weight, everything, and Tony would guess his bats every time. That's who Tony Gwynn is. Cal Ripken, on the other hand, is just the same as far as being analytical and really smart as a player. And what he did, Bill, through all his smarts, was he learned how to play the game better than anyone else, and he changed a position. He took shortstop and made it from a defensive position into an offensive position, and never, ever losing fact that defense was an extremely important part of that job. He turned little shortstops into big ones. And when you ask Alex Rodriguez, Derek Jeter, Chipper Jones, Troy Glaus, Nomar Garciaparra, all these big offensive shortstops who came up, who was the guy that turned you on to shortstop? And they all said Cal Ripken.
Probably ought to mention that Ripken was pretty dependable in terms of showing up for work each day, too.
And, Bill, I purposely don't mention that for this reason. We all know about the record. Nobody is ever going to break that record. It is the most astounding thing that I have seen in 25 years covering baseball, but it does not define who he is. He's one of the three greatest shortstops of all time, and again, he changed the position. That's how we need to remember Cal Ripken, not as the guy who showed up every day. That's the reason everybody loves him, but in the end, the reason he was so great is because his talent allowed him to play a defensive position in a very offensive way.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill.
Okay, here's a word association exercise. Think Kansas and college basketball. What does that make you think of? Precisely, Jayhawks. But there's another Sunflower State squad led by a former Jayhawk that aims to add Shockers to the mix. Greg Eklund recently traveled to Wichita to see how the Wichita State Shockers intend to do that, and he has this report.
As a city closely associated with aircraft manufacturing, Wichita is billed as the air capital of the world. Last spring, it was the college basketball fans of Wichita State who were sky high when the Shockers reached the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament. But they were not the lone representative of the Missouri Valley Conference in the Sweet 16. Bradley also made it, and it started with a victory over the better-known team from the Sunflower State, the Kansas Jayhawks.
Bennett to the line. Missed it. Rebound Rush. Fires it. Lost it. The Braves win it for the first time in 20 years. Bradley wins an NCAA game, and Billy Packer, they do play basketball in the Missouri Valley Conference. Take note, next Selection Sunday, the Bradley Braves.
Bradley play-by-play voice Dave Snell was referring to the comments made by CBS television analyst Billy Packer, who disagreed with the inclusion of four teams from the Valley in the 65-team field. The conference's postseason success has carried over to this season, especially with the Shockers. Until Wichita State's wins at LSU and at Syracuse last month, no Valley team since the AP poll was instituted in 1949 had ever beaten two ranked teams on the road in the same season, Wichita State coach Mark Turgeon.
Yeah, to go on the road and do that with their officials is pretty special, and I was really proud of what we've accomplished.
Turgeon attended high school in Topeka, but he knew very little about the Shockers until they knocked the Jayhawks out of the NCAA tournament in 1981.
I was a junior in high school. I know exactly where I was when it happened because it was such a shock. I had no respect for Wichita State's program at the time, and they had a heck of a program.
Turgeon played college ball at KU and was part of the Jayhawks' Final Four team in 1986. He's now in his seventh season as the Shockers' coach. Now that Wichita State has risen to national prominence, Jayhawks coach Bill Self is hearing from fans who want a game between the two schools. Here's a sample from Hawk Talk, Self's weekly coach's call-in show.
Let's go to Topeka and say hi to John. John, nice to have you on with us.
Hi, Coach. Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good, John.
Question about next year. I know that K-State looks like they may meet the Wichita Shockers in a tournament. Would you consider next year or the following year to go 1-1 or 2-1 games and play the Shockers like K-State should play the Shockers?
Well, you know something, it's from a fan's perspective, and with all due respect, what you're saying is not wrong. But your bots are sometimes from a fan's perspective and what should happen and what shouldn't happen. And in all honesty, schools should schedule the way that they think best benefits them.
Translation, Self does not see the matchup as beneficial to KU. Turgeon doesn't disagree.
I want to do a home and home. I think our fans deserve that, and our program's really grown. So I don't think it's going to happen. You got to understand, too, if you're in Bill's shoes, I'm a former Jayhawk. We've done well here. It's a no-win for him, so I can't blame KU or Bill Self for not wanting to play us.
Shocker banner for you?
Thank you.
Within the city of Wichita, Shockers basketball is the biggest show in town during the winter months. Until last season, when the Shockers won the Valley regular season title, then made its run in the NCAA tournament, Turgeon found plaudits hard to come by outside Wichita.
We were starting to gain respect, but we were still thought of as a second-class citizen to KU and K-State in the state, and even nationally. But I think winning the league last year and then doing what we did in the NCAA tournament put us on another level in people's eyes, and they view us differently now.
All right, Shocker fans, here we go. Put your hands together. Make some noise. Everybody up in Charles Koch Arena.
Even senior guard Karen Bradley has a different view than he did a few years ago. Before transferring to WSU in 2004, he played on the Marquette team that made it to the 2003 Final Four, where the Golden Eagles lost to the Kansas Jayhawks in the semifinals. Like Turgeon two decades earlier, Bradley didn't know about the caliber of basketball further south on the Kansas Turnpike.
Really, I didn't, but as I was transferring, when I came here on my visit, I knew right away how good this team was going to be. And, I told myself coming here that the team here was better than that Final Four team at Marquette.
After a 9-0 start this season, the Shockers lost four in a row and have tumbled out of the rankings. Tonight, they'll be at home against Evansville. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Wichita.
Come to Wichita. Won't be there in 40 days. This is an evil land.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Eastern Ski Resorts plead, let it snow, let it snow, please let it snow. But first, if the gaudy figures dangling from the contract that will bring David Beckham to the Los Angeles Galaxy in August are not imaginary numbers, Mr. Beckham will be the most handsomely compensated athlete in the world, whether or not he is still at the top of his game as a soccer player. Joining me now to discuss the impact of the $250 million man is David Hershey, who is Senior Vice President and Executive Editor for HarperCollins. He also writes a weekly soccer column for Deadspin.com. David Hershey, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill.
David Beckham has said that he wants to lift the sport of soccer into prominence in the U.S. Is Major League Soccer's very expensive gamble that he will be able to do that realistic?
Well, certainly David Beckham will raise the profile of a league that gets very little respect around the world. But whether he can raise the level of play in the United States and galvanize the a young American soccer fan remains to be seen. And I say that as a fan of David Beckham and the American editor of his autobiography.
Well, you've been writing about soccer for 30 years. You helped Pelé write his book as well. Is there a comparison between Pelé and the old North American Soccer League and Beckham in MLS?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to delineate between Pelé and Beckham. Pelé was the greatest player in the history of the game, who came here past his prime to spread the gospel of soccer in America. Beckham is the world's most famous soccer player, who is not yet over the hill and still has a few mind-bending free kicks left in him. But his appeal is less for what he does I think, on the soccer field than for what he does off of it. And I think that is brought out in the way his $250 million contract has been structured. 80% of it has nothing to do with kicking a ball for the Los Angeles Galaxy. They are betting on him essentially as a marketing phenomenon. He has this aura about him that few athletes in the world do.
Now, I wonder if it's an aura that others will seek. Do you suppose that right after the Beckham deal was announced, Ronaldinho was on the phone to his agent saying, get me to MLS?
Well, I don't think Ronaldinho, because Ronaldinho is 26 years old and the best player in the world. But yes, other sort of aging superstars who see that number and would be happy to settle for one-fifth of it, I think will be anxious to come to America. And that is a good thing because, for the most part, they've been derisive about playing in the States.
The Galaxy has announced that on Thursday they sold over 1,000 season tickets after the announcement. But how do season ticket sales, jersey sales, TV revenues, sponsor dollars even begin to make up what the Galaxy and the league have agreed to pay this guy?
Well, I think so much of it is an investment in the future of American soccer that I don't think anybody expects to make a lot of money out of this except for Beckham himself. Pelé, when he came here in 1975, got, I don't know, close to $3 million. And the Cosmos had a tsunami of red ink on the books for 5 or 6 years, but they did establish themselves and the sport for a few glorious seasons as the hot ticket. And I think that's what they're betting on in L.A.
In a piece that you wrote for the website Deadspin this week, you had some fun with the idea that David Beckham's employment by the Galaxy would be great for the L.A. club scene and, of course, for his wife's career, the career she hopes to establish in this country. But will his arrival make the Galaxy a much better team?
Well, you know, that remains to be seen. He will certainly make the Galaxy a much more watched and scrutinized team. But I don't know that David Beckham's presence on the field alone will be enough to vault them into the realm of a top-tier franchise. They will need two or three David Beckhams before they can challenge any of the major clubs in Europe.
Well, that's only $750 million.
Well, I doubt, Bill, that any other soccer player will be paid more than David Beckham. So another $100 million for two or three players should suffice.
You're a New Yorker. Have you already bought your ticket for the Galaxy's first visit to play the Red Bulls?
Well, I didn't even know that the schedule has been announced yet. But if you're asking, would I go? Sure, I'm curious. On the other hand, I've been referred to as a Euro snob because I like to watch English football on TV rather than going to a stadium and watching what I think is a mid-level level of play.
Well, then I should ask you, how good do you think Fulham's going to be with Dempsey?
Well, I actually think that is very exciting, that an American born and bred player is going over to England to join two other Americans on a premiership team. That's why I think the sport has a chance, and that Beckham will certainly have a great effect on all these kids who are kicking ball across the landscape of ours.
David Hershey has been writing about soccer for 30 years. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Absolutely, Bill, and I'll see you at the Galaxy game.
In NFL playoff action today, the Baltimore Ravens play the Indianapolis Colts, and therein lies a tale of treachery, among other things. Joining me on the line from Baltimore is Baltimore Sun columnist David Steele. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Some of our listeners may need a quick history lesson. Can you tell us in a minute or less why and how the Colts left Baltimore back in 1984?
I think I could do it in a minute or less. I mean, most people here in Baltimore would take about 3 hours venting about the whole manner of it. But essentially, in the middle of the night, in late March 1984, there were a bunch of reports spread throughout the Baltimore area that the series of moving vans, Mayflower vans, as everybody here knows by heart now, were seen going into and leaving the Ravens, the Colts practice facility out in suburban Baltimore. Robert Irsay had ordered them at the last second. Negotiations on a new stadium and a lease had broken up at the last second. He was packing everything up that the Colts owned and was putting them on the highway to Indianapolis, where they were going to get a new stadium and have a brand new life. And basically, people woke up that morning, saw the reports on the news, the Mayflower vans going through the night in the snow. And that basically Baltimore has never been the same since.
All right, but it's been 23 years since the Colts left Maryland under cover of darkness. The Ravens have won a Super Bowl since then, playing in Baltimore. Baltimoreans can't still care about the Colts, can they?
It's an interesting dichotomy right now. It's almost as if half the city, and half the area rather, deeply, deeply cares about the Colts. They've never forgotten them as their childhood heroes. That was the team of their youth and their childhood, and you know it'll always have their hearts. And then there's a whole new generation that's grown up since then that knew nothing of the Colts and just knew either of this 12-year void of football in Baltimore, or they know about the Ravens.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really kind of a generational battle going on right now.
Now, this is the generation of people who call in talk shows and say, for goodness sake, stop talking about the old Colts. Talk about the Ravens.
Exactly. And there's been a big battle that's gone on back and forth almost nonstop. Really, even before the playoffs began, when it got late in the season, and the possibility of playing the Colts started to arise. And then when the realization was that if they were going to play the Colts were going to come to Baltimore for this game. And they've come back a few times for regular season games, and the craziness has just gone to another level each time. But this could just top every possible lunacy record that the city has ever endured.
Well, David, you and I know that teams have left cities before in all sorts of sports, not just football, and frequently for sweet stadium deals somewhere else. What makes the ongoing relationship between the Colts and Baltimore so intense?
Baltimore's kind of a different kind of town. Really, in Baltimore, for years, the identity of the city, certainly the positive identity of the city anybody ever had, was of the Orioles and of the Colts, and the great, incredibly successful teams they could be proud of, and players that were part of the community. They lived here. You know, people saw them all the time. There was just an identity with those players and with that team that really was unique among pretty much any other city and any other teams. And that was really torn apart in the worst way. I mean, I think if they had just left like any other team had left, they hold a press conference and say we've reached an agreement, blah blah blah. It would have been bad, but not nearly as bad as waking up in the morning and saying, hey, the team just drove out of town and they're never coming back.
Well, David, this is the point in the conversation when normally I would ask for a pick in the game today, but I'm going to twist that question a little bit. What result should we hope for in terms of greatest potential for celebration and minimizing riot possibilities?
I think that a lot of people would really love to see the Ravens win this game just to give some closure to all of this, because that's really been hanging over. I mean, even though the Ravens have won and the Colts really have not over the years, and even though the Colts have had regular season success, I think it would really mean something to the people here to see, for the old Colts factions, to see the team that abandoned them kind of shut down by the new team. And for the new team, you know, the fans of the new team, I think they'd like to hear, hey, you know, this is kind of the end of it. We've kind of put an exclamation point on all this. The Colts have been vanquished. You know, the Ravens are now everybody's team. Everybody can share them and understand the joy and kind of all group together. So I think that would be the ideal. I think that'd be the ideal outcome. And obviously, if the Colts win the game, rather, it could get ugly around here.
David Steele is a sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun. David, thanks again.
Thanks again for having me.
Cannon Mountain Ski Resort in New Hampshire is throwing its annual beach party tonight, but this year the seasonal contrast is sorely lacking. Balmy temperatures have hurt New England's multi-billion-dollar winter recreation industry to the extent that some worry ski resorts will be forced out of business and the region's winter sports culture will be changed forever. Only a Game's Kurt Nickisch reports.
No snow, no snowboarders.
Everything's down. Percentage-wise, probably 30-40% from last season, and last season wasn't a good year.
That's David Swenson. He manages a ski shop in Bartlett, New Hampshire.
2 years like this? Glad I don't own the place. Truly, I'm glad I don't own the place. I'd never own one of these places.
A spray of synthetic flakes clouds the summit of Loon Mountain, where snowmaking manager Ken Mack is treating trails that are already open. He'd like to be coating new ones, but rain and 60-degree temperatures last weekend melted the main runs away. He's taken advantage of the cooler temps this week to repair the damage.
It is depressing. All you can really do is make the best of it and hold out some hope that the jet stream will shift south and we'll get some cold weather in here.
Which is in the forecast next week, unfortunately after this key 3-day holiday weekend. Loon Mountain already lost out during the chief money-making time over Christmas and New Year's. The resort says ski visits were down 25%. Unstrapping his alpine boots in the lodge, Joe Messer, a CPA from Massachusetts, sounds more bored than elated after a day on the slopes.
It's a little disappointing, the lack of snow we've had, but you got to depend on Mother Nature, so that's the way it goes.
Messer thought about canceling his trip like others have, but he'd already locked in vacation time.
Too bad Colorado couldn't share a little of their snow with us in the Northeast.
Colorado's where another skier, Jim Hepler of Pennsylvania, is thinking about going next year instead. He's been skiing New England for 20 years and rates the slopes this season a 2 out of 10.
Do you ever hear of Go West, young man? Well, you know, we're not going to continue to come for twos.
Losing skiers to snowier regions could become the norm, says Cliff Brown. The University of New Hampshire researcher has studied how the number of ski resorts in the region is dropping as annual temperatures rise. 6 out of 10 New Hampshire ski areas have gone out of business since the 1970s. Smaller, family-run resorts closed first. They couldn't afford to blow snow. Now Brown says climate change is causing extreme variation in winter weather, which is squeezing the surviving areas.
A ski resort, for example, that's struggling one year to the next may be driven out of business by a couple of bad seasons in a row. And that's a scenario that's totally possible in the current environment.
Brown says diehard skiers and snowboarders will keep coming, but it's the more casual tourists who really keep the resorts going. He says if this keeps up, they may head to western slopes or none at all.
So instead of January going up to Maine or northern New Hampshire for a week of skiing, they may go to Florida.
Where business is actually good in New England ski towns, it's for a bad reason. Janelle Bard is a chiropractor in Lincoln, New Hampshire. Her office visits are up almost 10% this season.
I'm seeing a lot of neck tension, shoulder tension, headaches due to the stress.
Her clients are ski resort managers and owners of businesses that cater to tourists.
When I start treating them and we start talking more about what the cause of the problem is, there's financial stress because of the conditions and everyone's taking a hit.
But amid swishing snow pants and the syncopated scrape of ski boots, Chris Elms is not too stressed out.
A couple of bad winters, if it gets you down, you shouldn't be in this business.
Elms runs ski operations in Bretton Woods in New Hampshire. He says the region's resorts have always competed with other parts of the country and with other forms of recreation.
The industry in the whole is competing against the warm weather, the cruise lines, the Disneylands, the Nintendo games. We need to do a better job of bringing younger people into this sport and get them off the couch, away from the TV sets and start enjoying some of this beautiful mountain scenery.
Elms says people in his industry do chat over hot chocolate about the threat of global warming, but no one's changing any business models. Bretton Woods is planning a huge expansion with condominiums and a shopping village. Even so, just the fact that the ski industry is now getting more of its revenues from real estate and retail shows that the nature of winter recreation is changing, says Cliff Brown of the University of New Hampshire.
Maybe things like skiing and snowmobiling and ice fishing, instead of being central to the wintertime culture of northern New England, move more to the periphery as the winters get warmer.
Riding the gondola up Loon Mountain, snowmaking manager Ken Mack hopes Brown is wrong, that warm winters will not become the norm and change the way people ski and snowboard.
There's been bad winters before, so my grandfather tells me. I think next winter, or perhaps even maybe later on this winter, next week it could turn cold, and we'll be right back at it. We'll be right up to where we should be.
For Only a Game, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Lincoln, New Hampshire.
Snow.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at bicon.com, bicon.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. This when I don't succeed
because I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a year in the fast basketball life of the Phoenix Suns. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
David Beckham, he of the impeccable free kick and perfect hair, will be a member of the Los Angeles Galaxy. Can he build a bridge between soccer and the U.S. and in so doing elevate Major League Soccer?
Yes, it worked with Pele 30 years ago for about half an hour. There's no reason why it shouldn't work for Bex. I will ask you, as a soccer guy, does he have anything left? I mean, is it worth buying a ticket to see this guy play?
It's definitely worth buying a ticket to see this guy play.
Not he just may, to say you saw David
no,
Beckham.
No, he may still be the best dead ball player in soccer.
Well, those of us who consider soccer being nothing but an endless succession of dead balls.
No, I'm talking about when the ball is sitting there ready to be kicked without moving.
Well, but can he still run up and down the field and do electric stuff?
I think for
limited periods of time. Or is this just old-timer's day at the ballpark?
No, it's not old-timer's day. He's 31, not 51. But where do you suppose MLS got the $250 million with which they will allegedly pay him?
Well, has anyone seen the members of the Columbus crew lately? Because I suspect they were all sold into bondage with the Malay Pirates to pay this bill.
Barry Bonds, currently in mid-negotiation with the Giants for a one-year deal that could keep him in San Francisco at least until he breaks Henry Aaron's career home run record, has some splaining to do regarding alleged use of amphetamines, especially now that he's acknowledged that it was not, in fact, the fault of somebody else, namely a teammate with a locker nearby.
Yeah, Mark Sweeney got pitched under the bus there in the early going of this story. You know, this is another big day for those people who want to hang Barry Bonds' head on their den wall and keep our children safe from whatever it is Barry Bonds is allegedly doing for them. It's another strike against the privacy involved in drug testing. These tests always manage to get out into the public sphere. And you know how hard it is not to use the word leak in this situation, by the way? You fail a test, people will find out about it, which is part of the reason why people are reluctant to take them. It probably has nothing to do with the whole steroid thing, but it is another check mark in the column.
Among the playoff matchups in the NFL today and tomorrow, what are your candidates for must-watch?
Well, I have a local and somewhat of a financial interest in the New England Patriots.
Tell me of that and let us sell some books.
And the San Diego Chargers. the most interesting game for 111 different reasons is Philadelphia at New Orleans. No one here knows what New Orleans is going to look like when they finally get finished turning it into Times Square theme park for rich jazz fans down there. It's been a terrific season. The New Orleans team is a very good team. Philadelphia's playing pretty well. That, to me, is the most interesting game, competitively and in terms of the whole atmosphere and general zeitgeist around it.
Well, the NFC thanks you for those words, I'm
but
sure.
But the last time I'm going to be interested in the NFC, until well after the Super Bowl, I suspect.
Meanwhile, the San Diego Chargers have denied tickets for tomorrow's AFC divisional game to New England Patriots fans, saying they only want Southern California residents on hand for that game. It's funny, I didn't know there were NFL fans who lived in Southern California.
Exactly the point I was going to make. This is a team that has not been able to show some of its home games on television because it's been blacked out because they haven't been sold out. I would think they would invite lots of people to come to the lovely city of San Diego and spend their money and paint. The people who sell red, white, and blue body paint in San Diego must be furious about this.
A funny thing happened to Ohio State on the way to their coronation as national champs.
They stunk!
Florida now has national championship teams in both basketball and football. So does this damage the school's academic reputation?
I suspect they will be building several new libraries with the proceeds of this wonderful twofer. Remember, however,
or new locker rooms and training rooms.
While they do own a national basketball championship, they don't own the national basketball championship because the women's basketball championship is somewhere else.
The organizers of the Australian Open are crowing, Charlie. The top 20 male players in the world are all in Melbourne for the first Grand Slam tournament of 07. 18 of the top 20 women are there as well. Have you made your picks?
I mean, the obvious men's pick is Roger Federer because he wins everything, so we'll just put that aside. It's good for the Australian Open, which is kind of the forgotten stepchild of the majors when everybody knows it's the French Open that deserves to be the rejected stepchild of the majors. It's good news for them, it's good news for the organizers, and it's good news for tennis fans, however many of them there are left in the United States of America.
Chris Webber is now a very richer man, as the saying goes, having been bought out of his contract this week by the Philadelphia 76ers, and he will likely choose his new employer sometime this weekend. Life is good for washed-up NBA power forwards, no?
It's wonderful to be in a position where your employer pays you a lot of money to get rid of you. That's a good thing, because then you don't have to play for the employer anymore.
And you have to go get some more money somewhere
else. He doesn't want to play for anybody who doesn't have a chance at the championship. I don't know who's going to pick him up. The Spurs aren't going to pick him up because they're too old right now. I don't see the Heat doing it. It's entirely possible the Pistons may bring him back to get whatever vestigial University of Michigan fans there are. I think it's also entirely possible that he won't catch on anywhere.
When Paul Appleby of Mansfield, Nottinghamshire, joined the Sutton and Ashfield Harriers Running Club, do you suppose he thought it was a secret running club?
Oh, and not only that, he did it in Britain, where the Sun can call him not Paul Appleby, but lying Paul Appleby in its lead. Apparently, Mr. Appleby spent 13 years taking disability money from whoever would offer it and is competing in the London Marathon, and has been photographed competing in the London Marathon several times after illegally, and I love the British tabloids, illegally trousering more than 22,000 pounds. When was the last time you trousered anything, Bill? I don't want to know.
This season, there will be an all-you-can-eat section at Dodger Stadium. What are people in Los Angeles getting too skinny?
Fighting the obesity epidemic, the Los Angeles Dodgers step up and develop a new slogan, don't be drunk, be fat at the ballpark. Because while you can have all you can eat, you can't get beer in the all you can eat section.
That's right. And finally, Charlie, perhaps you would like to explain why Tara Chuffey of New Orleans wins the designation as this week's unluckiest planner.
Well, Tara, who was planning to get married on Saturday evening, wound up with a playoff game being dropped on her head. And she said, I feel really, really bad for people who already had playoff tickets who have to be at the wedding. I think Tara may be adjusting her standards for the phrase, who have to be at the wedding.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Since the Patriots are still alive, he still wishes to be known as the author of Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything. Charlie joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Paul.
What a beautiful day for a wedding in May. See the people all stare at the lovable pair. The bells are ringing.
Jack McCallum has been writing for Sports Illustrated for more than 25 years. For his most recent book, McCallum decided to spend a season with an NBA team. The result is 7 seconds or less, my season on the bench with the running and gunning Phoenix Suns. Jack McCallum joins me now from the studios of KUER in Salt Lake City. Jack, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
At what point during your association with the Suns did you find yourself thinking, ah, yes, I have picked the right team to follow?
I think, Bill, it was probably early in January or late in December. I can't remember. I had started the project basically in training camp, which is October. Mm-hmm. And I got an email from my wife, who heretofore had been extremely disinterested in sports, which is probably why we're still together. And she said, I stayed up watching the Suns last night. That Diaw's really going to be a player. And I said, wow. And I'm saying that, you know, honestly, seriously, because there's just something attractive about the team. I kind of knew it from the beginning, but this was sort of a really special season. I mean, they had a, you know, one of their main players hurt, and they were integrating two or three new guys, including Boris Diaw, Rajah Bell, both of whom turned out to be kind of cult stars in their own way. I was just so fortunate because a lot of times in this business, you do not get the desired result, that's for sure.
You characterize Phoenix as, quote, the sporting world's answer to jazz. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that basketball, as you know, is sort of looked upon by the non-basketball-watching public as this kind of wild and wacky free-for-all. In point of fact, the NBA's problem is that it has been traditionally the antithesis of that. And we've talked about that a little bit before on the show, that there's too much defense, there's too much coach interference, there's too many set plays, there's not enough scoring. Well, the Suns came along and said, you know, we're going to try to get up a shot within 7 seconds of the shot clock, which accounts for the title of the book. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, we can get a good shot. Furthermore, we're going to commit fewer turnovers because we're throwing fewer passes. So they have kind of an improvisational style to their play, which actually is belied a little bit by the work the coaches do behind the scenes. But when they get out on the court, it is a little bit like a great jazz performance.
Why is it that the Suns can make that fast break style of play work while other teams, the coaches just say they're going to do it and they can't make it work?
Exactly. I mean, since the Suns have done this, since Mike D'Antoni came there 3 seasons ago now and announced they were going to do this, I've heard this from 100 coach. Well, not 100 because there's not 100 teams in the league, but every coach, oh, my God, we want to play this way. Gee, we think it's great, but we don't have Steve Nash. So there's this kind of eternal polemic in the league whether Nash makes the Suns or whether the Suns make Nash. Obviously, the Suns would not be as good doing this without Steve Nash. However, it's hard to believe somewhere else there's not another guy that, had a coach been fully committed to that style, would be able to run and gun like the Phoenix Suns do.
Of course, the flip side of having Steve Nash on your team is other overly sensitive players may feel that they're not getting sufficient attention because Nash gets so much. One of the first observations in the book that surprised me was your contention that Sean Marion, certainly a star in his own right, quote, lives in a perpetual state of fear that he is being overlooked, under-respected, ignored, dissed, persecuted, singled out, patronized, whatever. Why is that?
Well, it's probably not because of his salary, because he makes about $15 million, which is more than Nash makes. Sean, you know, brings this upon himself. Within 5 minutes of any conversation with Sean Marion, I mean, you can be talking about the weather, and he will somehow bring it around to the fact that he is, you know, kind of tired about being the organization's eternal third wheel. Steve's the MVP. Why aren't I the MVP? You know, and I put in the book that, you know, large salaries do not make you invulnerable to human frailties. And this is Sean's particular one.
During a game in the playoff series between the Suns and the Lakers, Rajah Bell, playing for the Suns, of course, essentially tackles Kobe Bryant, playing for the Lakers. To nobody's surprise, Bell is subsequently suspended. There's some worry that he'll be suspended for more than one game. How did you approach asking Bell about that play?
With trepidation. I remember the day after Rajah did that, he comes into the gym, and Steve Nash was down there, and Steve, you know, I talked about in the book, kind of greeted him like a rock star, and Rajah looks kind of abashed a little bit. You know, he doesn't know. He knows he's going to get his butt suspended, and it was a stupid play. And I go over and throw a couple lob balls at him, and I finally said to Rajah, man, what did you do that for? You know, and he had this great explanation. I still remember he said, first of all, he doesn't like Kobe Bryant. I mean, the word detest would not be too strong, but you know, Rajah said, you know, I just looked at him and I was going, Rajah, all right, don't do it. Don't do it. You're going to do it. You're going to do it. Damn, you did it. You know, that he couldn't restrain himself. And I mean, I talked in the book about Rajah being, you know, the nicest guy in the world, but having a true anger management problem, to which the coach at Boston University, as a matter of fact, when he was there, sent him to get anger management counseling when he was a a sophomore. So, you know, maybe that's what he needs for his competitive edge. Maybe it's genetic, because Raja told me he remembers going to his father's 50 and over national tournament games, and his father got thrown out of two 50 and over tournaments for fighting with an opponent. So Raja kind of comes by it naturally.
You write that you went out of your way not to flaunt your access when other writers were present, and that was certainly thoughtful. But what did you learn as a constant presence with the Suns that you wouldn't have learned had you been a beat writer or just a guy doing another feature story for Sports Illustrated?
I wouldn't have thought much about, you know, the guys that are the third, the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth player on the roster with this eternal jostling to find their identity. You know, I wouldn't have had a good sense of that as I did hanging around with Raja and Eddie House and even Pat Burke, the 12th man on the team. That was one thing. Another thing would be how eternal this up-and-down rhythm of the season is, particularly among the coaching staff. They would lose a game on Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, I swear, in a coach's meeting, it would be, my God, we're never going to win another game. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do? Then they'd win that night's game, and it would be, we're never going to lose again. It was up and down. It was up and down. It was taking care of little fires. Sean didn't get enough shots last game. How do we get him more shots? Raja was mad that he wasn't in on crunch time. How can we figure out how to play everybody? These a million questions, and one of the things I found out was the coaching staff that figures out which of these little questions to worry about and which ones do you have to table, they're going to be, by and large, the successful ones.
You point out in your epilogue that the cast of characters in Phoenix has changed considerably since last year. How do you like the Suns' chances this time around?
I still think, when I look at the league, that a team like the Dallas Mavericks and the San Antonio Spurs can still play volleyball up on the backboard, that the Suns don't have quite enough rebounding toughness and quite enough defensive stoppedness, which is not a word, I might add. But
it ought to be.
All right, well, let's make it one. that they don't have those periods of time when they can lock you down for 3 or 4 minutes. They're not a bad defensive team. I mean, they are not a horrible defensive team. But I don't think they're as good as the Mavericks defensively, and I don't think they're as good as the Spurs. And the Eastern Conference notwithstanding, I'm not sure what's even going on there between Detroit and Cleveland. I still personally put them as the third best team in the West, and if they're by any chance listening to this, they're going to give me some crap the next time I see them, but I hold to that position.
Jack McCallum is the author of 7 Seconds or Less, My Season on the Bench with the Runnin' and Gunnin' Phoenix Suns, published by Simon & Schuster. He joined me from the studios of KUER in Salt Lake City. Jack, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from the Jayhawk Audio Network, WMBD, and JMP Radio Group in Peoria, Illinois, and from Lewis Downey of member station KUER in Salt Lake City. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about 7 Seconds or Less, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from soccer writer David Hershey, who finds yet another way to calculate the enormity of David Beckham's contract with the Los Angeles Galaxy.
In the 10 minutes that you and I talk, he will have made probably $17,000. So that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, that's at least a couple of frothy lattes in Los Angeles and maybe some left over for a Dodger dog. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at wkkf.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org.